Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do human brains take at least 25 years to fully develop? And how do our experiences during childhood both grow and prune this vital organ? Those questions are among the areas of interest at the University of Oregon's Brain Development Lab, which has also studied what it takes to help children cultivate working memory and the ability to focus attention on tasks at hand, both key elements to success in school and then in adult life. Helen Neville is director of the lab, and she's in town to lecture on why a child's brain develops the way it does tonight at 7 as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Helen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Aside from formal education, what sorts of experiences contribute to babies and to children's abilities to develop their brains to the fullest extent possible?
Well, families are very important. Mm-hmm. Of course, formal education doesn't begin until usually 5 at the earliest. And it's in those first 5 years that the brain is undergoing massive changes in its structure and in its function. The 2-year-old child has twice as many connections between neurons in their brain as their pediatrician. Did you know that? Yes, there's a marked overproduction of connections or synapses in the brain. And then we lose about 50% of those synapses. And that's a good thing. It's the way that experience shapes a developing brain. So it's sort of like experience acts like a sculptor by starting with more material than they end up with and removing bits to reveal a final shape. And so during those first 5 years before formal education, lots of changes are occurring. And of course, for a child, parental nurturance is a very key factor. Lots of studies have shown that this is not only true in humans, it's true in rats and monkeys, that nurturance from the parents in most animals, it's maternal nurturance. Of course, in humans, it can be both maternal and paternal. But these influences are very important. In addition, everything matters. Like, for example, just the kind of visual input a child gets. So if a child has, say, a wandering eye, it's very important that get aligned within the first 11 months, or the neurons in your brain that are responsible for seeing in depth will never develop the capability of seeing in depth.
Because the brain favors the eye that works properly.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then instead of there being binocular neurons that get input from both eyes, basically the good eye, which is focused, will take over all the neurons. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not good for depth perception. And similarly, if a child is born with cataracts, they need to be removed within the first 5 weeks or the child will never have normal acuity. Similar situation in hearing and language. If a child doesn't hear a lot of language, I mean, there are parts of the brain, you see, that are predisposed to process vision, language, hearing, attention. And if those kind of inputs are not stimulated, if we don't get stimulation by the appropriate inputs, which is normal maternal nurturance, then those circuits will do something else. For example, about the back third of our brains processes visual information from the world. In a person born blind, it's not getting any visual inputs. Mm-hmm. What happens? Well, when I started out in this business, people said, well, it would just atrophy. But in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The back third of the brain is an exquisite auditory processor in people who are blind and tactile, touch processor. So the brain is looking for inputs. If they're not there, it'll do something else. There's a lot of brain plasticity, and your listeners will have heard that many times. But it's not limitless, like different subsystems within vision, for example, are highly changeable or plastic. What that means is they can be enhanced, but plasticity is a double-edged sword. So if the inputs aren't there, it will be vulnerable. And some systems are much more constrained. They don't change when experience is different. Some systems only change during certain time windows. But there are multiple different time windows in human development. Of course, we have to find out what those time windows are so that we can optimize child development. And then there's a third type of brain system which remains changeable throughout life. Of course, those are the ones we want to target in adult education.
Mm-hmm. Those are the things, the acquisition of knowledge. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about parents who want the very best for their children. We know it's important now to talk to kids a lot, and the exposure to words really matters. Why are children from lower income homes likely to hear fewer words? Now, I understand that people with less education might have smaller vocabularies, but do they actually speak to their children less?
Yes, that's been well documented. Probably one of the reasons is that it's a lack of education. I mean, I've had low-income parents tell me, well, I didn't know you were supposed to talk to them all the time. And then, I mean, they just don't know. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons we made the DVD that I'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But and also, often, this kind of parenting is not modeled. So they have no familiarity with that kind of parenting, which is listening to your child. The other thing is, often, the kind of conversations that go on in certain homes are one way. So the parent is either doing all the talking or just saying, shut up. So it's usually one way. And what we talk to parents about a lot in our program that I'll talk about tonight is turn taking. So if your child serves you a sentence, return a sentence, not five, mm-hmm. one. On topic. And this kind of turn-taking really changes family relationships. And we can document that because we videotape parents and children interacting before and after our training program. And it really changes. Parental behavior can change. It's a matter of education.
That's so interesting because I guess educating at-risk kids really has to start with educating their parents, because I'm guessing if you wait until even Head Start, it's too late to sort of enhance these things?
We've been working with Head Start families. So these children are 3, 4, and 5 years of age, and we've seen massive changes mm-hmm. in parental behavior, in child behavior, reduction of sort of problem behavior, and also in child cognition, measures of language, preliteracy, IQ, and brain function. Because we just put little pieces of silver on the scalp and we can pick up the electrical potentials that are elicited when children are presented with different kinds of information. And they change.
So a lot of middle-class parents are very interested in getting all the latest educational materials, and there is no shortage of companies promising to sort of create products that will make a smarter child. Do we need those, or is it enough to be talking to our kids, exposing them to things in the world, making sure they get plenty of time to run around and eat properly, or do they need all these special things you can buy?
They don't need any of those special things. And mm-hmm. furthermore, the special things have not usually been empirically tested. Mm-hmm. They're not evidence-based. So, you know, in order to know whether baby Einstein...
Einstein himself never got, we should
no,
say.
makes a difference, you'd have to randomly assign families to either get them or not use them, and then test the kids before and after exposure to them for a certain amount of time, and then do the post-testing. This is how you test to see if something works or not. That's the only way we know if something is true. They don't do that. Those products are not evidence-based. Indeed, much of educational curricula are not evidence-based, but don't get me started.
Can we assume that a lot of things that appear to be behavioral problems in kids are in fact related to where they are in terms of brain development? I mean, I remember in preschool, you know, there's this idea that, you know, a 1-year-old ought to be able to share with another 1-year-old, until I read that in fact they can't really understand that yet. They play sort of parallel to one another, and because they're not in a place where they're really able to understand give and take yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Attentional systems and self-regulation take a long time to develop, and they have many different stages, and children's reactions to certain events are highly predictable, you know, as a function of what age they are and what they can do and what they can understand. So, for example, it's very typical for two-year-old kids to be frustrated and they're not really terrible twos. They're on their way to developing good self-regulation, but they haven't. And then it's not until at least 3 or 4 years of age that children develop what's called a theory of mind, which is the ability to understand what it might be like to be in that other guy's shoes. They have no idea until then, you know. So scientists have tested this in many different ways, but it's very clear it's quite a long developing system. And then, of course, some people never really develop that.
And we can all point to people down the block or in the long set of in-laws. Helen Neville is my guest. She's director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon and will be lecturing tonight on why a child's brain develops as it does. That takes place at 7. It's part of the UTD Center for Brain Health's lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can find information at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. We also have links off the Think page of KERA.org. We'll resume our conversation with Helen in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. For now, we want to give you an update on this challenge grant we have going. $1,500 pledged by Robert Verdon, who's a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. If we can get 75 of you listening to Think to contribute before 2 o'clock, before the end of Think today, we have 36 to go. That's great progress, and I really appreciate that. Let's not get too confident here, though, and please don't let your membership donation slide because you think we're going to make it.
Yeah, don't expect someone else to do your part. I'm Jeff Whittington, by the way, and here with Chris Boyd, and what a great conversation. And, you know, it's your contributions that make this kind of programming possible. And today it's really crucial we hear from you during the show today, this hour, because there's a $1,500 challenge grant on the table from Robert Verdon. He's a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. We've got to hear from 75 of you. We have heard from Marilyn Lamon in Bedford. Thank you so much, Marilyn. Thanks to Robert Jones in Dallas, George Bogard in Rowlett, Zia Hamzy in Plano, Julia Jordan in Dallas, Maria Hasbani in Dallas, and Linda Borchert in Grapevine. We'd love to hear from you at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Thank you also so much, Shelley Gallant in Dallas, Rajiv Arora in Plano, Jay Oralup in Fort Worth, and Daniel Flores in Fort Worth. We appreciate your contributions, and you can join this esteemed list of people. Think listeners are some of our best supporters, and we know we can always come to you when we need money, and we appreciate your support. Today, it's especially important because your contribution, in whatever amount it is, you know, it might be $100, but you can help us get to that extra $1,500 from Robert Verdon, this wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas, who is a fan of KERA, a fan of Think, and really wants to help extra money come into the station. I'm having trouble talking today.
Well,
I should ask Helen Neville why that might be.
I think you sound fine. Robert's leveraging his gift of $1,500. He's putting a condition on it. We've got to hear from 75 of you in order to accept this contribution from Robert Verdon. And, you know, it's pretty smart because if you have been thinking about making a contribution, well, think about, Robert matching a portion of your contribution with his $1,500 challenge. Of course, we have to hear from you for that to happen. And these are contributions at any level. We're talking about an additional gift of $5, $10, $15, or maybe a first-time membership of $50, or maybe you joined in the fall and you can afford to do another gift at the same level during this winter campaign to help us especially meet this goal this hour.
Your contribution at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. We'll join people like S.T. Lynch in Malakoff, Texas. Thank you so much. K. Merkel Boroff in Dallas. Anthony Boland in Highland Village. Thanks to Scott and Mindy Mashburn in Dallas. Kathy Mackin in Plano. And thanks to David DeFrance in Euless.
1-888-694-6931 is the number to call. You can do your part online as well at KERA.org. Of course, more conversation with Helen Neville coming up after this quick break. But take this moment right now to call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at KERA.org. Just 36 more contributions to meet the goal and to be able to accept the challenge.
You can be one of those right now. Thanks for your help.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Helen Neville is my guest this hour. She's director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon and is in town to deliver a lecture entitled Why Does a Child's Brain Develop as It Does? That takes place tonight at 7 as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health's lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Find more information at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Helen, what relationship does the development of motor skills have to the development of cognitive skills?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of research, principally by people at the University of Illinois, just showing the importance of movement, exercise, in particular aerobic exercise, actually in cognition, the structure of the brain and the function of the brain. So Art Kramer's work there, he initially began by looking at older individuals, people who were 75 or older, who weren't moving much or getting much physical exercise. And he randomly assigned them to either do walking, a little bit of aerobics, or toning, stretching, those two groups. And he tested them before and after using the MRI to image the brain and tests of cognition. And there were big changes, but only in one group. What group do you think?
The group that exercised.
The aerobic.
Aerobic exercise. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, it was maybe a little counterintuitive, but, you know, yoga and stretching, it's good. But aerobics is important for brain function.
Talk about in children, why it seems to be such a challenge, or why it takes so long to develop the ability to focus on a particular task?
Wow, that's a great question, because it does take a while, and it also takes practice. And this is something that the people at the Center for Brain Health know. I've seen it written in their newsletter called Brain Matters. But the ability, people use the word attention in a lot of different ways. But I use it in the same way that William James, at the turn of the 19th century, used it, a great philosopher and psychologist. So attention is selection, really. It's the ability to focus on one thing, say one auditory conversation at a cocktail party, mm-hmm. one thought, one visual object, and you focus on it for further processing, and we call that signal enhancement. But it also implies there's another mechanism of attention.
You have to tune out all that other stuff.
That's right. You have to ignore or suppress the input from what you're not attending. And we call that distractor suppression. And you really need to exercise focus and distractor suppression in order to keep them tuned up. And it really can help your child grow their attention by enjoying focusing on something with them. For example, it's really fun to watch snails interact, make a little terrarium. These snails are really curious and playful, actually. And so this is one of the things that we do with our kids, our Head Start kids. And, you know, this kind of focus, keep focusing, what are they doing now? And then at the same time, help them ignore the distractors. Sometimes we get some of the children playing with balloons in the other part of the room, but we encourage them, keep looking at the snails.
And snails are slow, which has to be good.
It's really good. Yeah. And it's not just children, but many adults really don't practice their focusing. You know, in a world of multitasking where people are, they're plugged in, they're on their cell, and they're texting at the same time. And so it's very important. Selective attention is a force multiplier. So, and it operates across domains of processing. So if you want to be a really good soccer player, you take your attention to the task of learning soccer, and you'll be a much better soccer player. If you want to learn the cello, you can't do it without this kind of focused attention. If you want to learn math, same thing. So it's a wonderful gain control mechanism that operates on anything that we want to do to make us do it better.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Ken in Allen. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ken. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. You got to a 3.5, almost a 4-year-old. Is it normal that they don't speak? Their speech didn't develop well yet where we can understand them? And to add on it, just if those kids shows, the wonderful characters we know, are they helpful? Because they ask kids to point things out and say words, are they helpful or not? And I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Those are both very big questions, but maybe you can talk a little bit about language development and how it happens in typical kids.
Mm-hmm. It's very important to distinguish between the ability to produce speech, which many children have difficulty actually articulation, and that's a very different skill than the ability to understand language. So if a 3-year-old child understands, for example, pick up the giraffe and put it over there on the couch, and they will do it, well, then language comprehension is good.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be able to speak. But it's important to distinguish between those two aspects of language and identify where the problem is. Typical language development, most children, well, they're understanding words actually by 8 months. So if you take an 8-month-old and say, where's the pussycat? They'll move their eyes over to where the pussycat is.
That's my favorite baby parlor trick, by the way.
Yeah. And but they're often not talking yet.
Mm-hmm.
But children usually, on average, you know, they say their first word about 12 months of age. This is just typical average. And then children start combining words. So, you know, little baby sentences like, mommy, up. That's a sentence. I mean, that's very clear intention. And that first starts to happen at about 20 months. And, you know, it's remarkable. By 3, most kids have really got a lot of language. But there are individual differences in the rate of development. And that could be okay. And it's just important to evaluate what a child does and what skills it does and doesn't have within language.
Talk about your labs have produced an instructional DVD for parents. Is that right? Can you talk about the kinds of families that this is geared toward and what you hope that they would get out of it?
Yeah, my students and I worked in our spare time to produce this DVD. It took us quite a few years, but...
You don't have much spare time.
I know. And so, because we have day jobs, research and teaching. But... It started with a seminar that I did we wanted to pull together everything that was known, that is currently known, about the effects of input from the environment on human brain development. So we researched vision, hearing, motor skills, attention, language, reading, math, music, learning, and emotions. And so we have segments on each of those topics in the DVD. And it's all, every statement that we make is supported by evidence, which is referenced at the end of the segment. And we also provide websites for further information about each of those topics. Every statement is evidence-based and has a reference. That's very important because a lot of such materials aren't evidence-based, but and actually what we made it for were non-neuroscientists. I mean, we're brain scientists, but most non-brain scientists don't even know that the human brain isn't mature for 25 years. They don't know that the brain in your head right now, that little 2 to 3 pound mass, is the consistency of room temperature butter. Oh, and they don't know that it's encased in a very, well, it's a hard bone, but it's worse than that. It's very jagged. So that if you shake a child or if you have a head-to-head contact in some sport, wow, I mean, there's a lot of brain bruising that goes on. And there's an animation of that I think, in our DVD, but I'm going to show that tonight. But it's like if you put a jello mold of a brain inside an actual human skull and shake it, ooh, it's frontal lobe damage. And, you know, because the head's usually going forward, and the frontal lobes, which are one of the hallmark features of the human brain and the human mind, those are the first to get damaged. And then when a brain moves forward, that action is followed by a reaction. So it bounds back, and so the back of the brain is bruised too. So
you want to make sure we take care of our baby's brain.
So we made this not just for parents. We made it for parents, teachers, policymakers. The people who make all the policies that affect children need to know these fundamental facts about the human brain. Well, I mean, everybody needs to know it, really.
So, you know, you said a lot of people don't know that the brain's not fully mature until age 25, at least. I would argue maybe people who've had a child through that age are fully aware of it. But is there an advantage to the fact that it takes decades to be sort of fully cooked?
Well, yes. The human brain really has the longest developmental time course. And what this sort of lays the groundwork for experience to have a big effect on the brain development. So instead of us being like, say, goslings who come with innate action patterns already fixed and kind of genetically determined, well, ours aren't. I mean, you know, of course there are genetic influences on the brain, but they are the consequences of those genetic effects are determined by the environment that they express themselves in.
My guest this hour is Helen Neville. She is director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon, speaking tonight to the UTD Center for Brain Health lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Her talk is called Why Does a Child's Brain Develop as It Does? It takes place tonight at 7. You can find information about the lecture at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. There's also a link, of course, off the think page of kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. Thanks to Dr. Neville for being our guest today. And being patient during our fundraising breaks, we want to also thank those of you who have called because, Chris, the great news is 21 contributions left to make our challenge grant goal of 75 contributions at any level between noon and 2 today. Just to remind everyone, this is we don't want to think that it's going to happen on its own, and we don't want you to think someone else is going to do your part for you, but we have a $1,500 at-risk challenge grant from Robert Verdon. He's a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. We must hear from 75 listeners with a contribution at any level by 2 o'clock. 21 contributions to go, so we're not there yet. Your call to 888-694-6931 or your online contribution right now at kera.org will help make sure we are able to accept this additional $1,500.
Thanks so much to Micah Jew in Garland, Skylar Fike in Dallas, Bobby Jones in DeSoto, and Jim Asaf in Dallas.
We also heard from Linda DeWeese in Murphy. Thanks to Patrick Wilson in Irving. I want to say I appreciate Deborah Anderson's contribution from Hickory Creek, and also thanks to Shelley Mathis in Granbury. It's great to hear from these communities all over North Texas. Thank you so much for stepping up and joining the thousands of folks we've heard from during this membership campaign. But you know what? It takes everyone joining together at whatever level is right for you to continue the reality of public radio in North Texas.
Your participation as a listener is great. We love that you call into the show, that you write to the show. We really appreciate that, and it's a huge part of what makes us successful. But the thing that makes it possible for us to turn on the lights every day, turn on the microphones, and switch on the tower, I guess they stay on most of the time, at least the tower does, is your money, really, because it takes a significant amount of money to run a radio station, even one like ours that tries very hard to keep things as close to the lowest cost as possible. Your contributions at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931 are critical to making sure public radio stays strong in your community.
These kinds of conversations are conversations that you appreciate. Well, that's why we do this show, because many of you have supported the program in the past and many of you listened to the show. We know that in January, we just got the numbers, over 100,000 individual podcast downloads were made for this show alone. That puts Think at the very top of the list of non-nationally distributed public radio shows in the country compared to all the other public radio shows around. And you know what? We even beat some national shows. with how many of you listen to the podcast. If you listen to this show via podcast, won't you consider supporting it with a contribution, especially this hour, if you happen to be streaming today instead of downloading. Of course, we'll take your contribution if you're listening days from
anytime.
Now, too.
but
right now, we do need to hear from 18 more listeners during this hour in order to achieve the challenge grant from Robert Verdon. It's a $1,500 challenge. He's a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. He's a fan of KERA. He's a supporter of KERA in addition to this challenge grant. So he already supports the station, but he's saying, I'm going to give $1,500 more to the station if we hear from 75 contributors during Think Today.
We so appreciate Robert Verdon's investment in this station, and we appreciate yours. You know, whether you're able to make a $1,500 contribution or $150 or $50 or whatever amount, you know, we like to name off numbers here, but the truth is you pick whatever amount you want to give to KERA and make a contribution, and we really appreciate it. You can do this online at kera.org. You can do it on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. If you were listening last hour and you wanted to get a copy of Parag Khanna's book, How to Run the World, we do still have those available at or above the $120 contribution level. In fact, I think most of the books we've talked about in the last couple of weeks are still available to you. Mm-hmm. So you can check all this out online or talk to the folks on the phone, and they should be able to help you out.
In the spirit of complete transparency, which is what we specialize here in here at KERA, we name off the different contributions levels, just hoping blindly that something will resonate with
you. Stick.
And then you'll say, oh yeah, $74.95, that sounds right for me. That's just perfect for my budget this year. But really, it's up to you. Our goal, our ultimate goal, yes, we have a $700,000 goal. Yes, we have a goal of 18 more contributions this hour in order to receive the $1,500 challenge grant from attorney Robert Verdon. But our ultimate goal is just your participation. And really, that's what we're after. You calling 888-694-6931 or you going online to kera.org to support this kind of conversation. Where else are you going to find an hour devoted to brain development? Well, not a whole lot of places. Public radio is where you get these kinds of conversations.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. KERA.org is the website. Thank you so much to Renea Ryland and Tom Luce in Dallas. Thank you to Abigail and Rick Beyer in Louisville, Susan Kleiman and Colin Evans in Dallas. And thanks to you, if you are on the line right now, we need 18 additional contributions by the end of this hour in order to accept the $1,500 challenge grant from Dallas attorney Robert Verdon. Your contribution now brings us that much closer. Call us or go online and give a contribution in any amount, and it will count toward that goal. Thank you so much.
Is that great? You doing okay?
Yeah.
Need anything?
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon, Helen Neville. She's in town to deliver a lecture entitled, Why Does a Child's Brain Develop as It Does? That takes place tonight at 7. It's part of the UTD Center for Brain Health's lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. And by the way, that DVD that Helen was talking about in the last segment, you can find a link to get a copy or to watch the video online at changingbrains, all one word, .org. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can get to us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here that says, I have a great-grandchild who seems to have either a photographic memory or is incredibly bright. What should we be doing to challenge her?
There are people with photographic memories, and we don't really... The mechanisms aren't well understood, but there have been some studies of such individuals. To challenge her, well, just the normal stimulating environment. I mean, give her lots of visual information, lots of auditory information, talk to her a lot.
There was a question in the last segment about, the second part of the question was about educational TV shows. And I'm curious about how you feel, where you stand on that. Are they truly educational?
Some are. And so, you know, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
Some programs are good. But what we suggest, and many people do, is that parents watch the programs with the children. In other words, instead of plunking a child down as you go and do your housework, take it as an opportunity to share stuff with your child and to talk about what's going on.
What is happening to the brains of teenagers that makes them so difficult to live with?
Well, the hormones that change around puberty and after, testosterone and estrogen, these are neurotransmitters in the brain. So, you know, the whole chemistry of the brain is changing because of these pubertal changes. And in addition, the longest developmental time course of any part of the brain occurs in the frontal lobes. So teenagers aren't all there. They don't have their frontal lobes yet. And the frontal lobes are the ones that help with self-regulation, emotional regulation. They're key for making a plan or a decision and sticking to it. So teenagers have a lot of chemical changes going on that can be unsettling, and they don't have the frontal lobe power, you know, to help them kind of regulate how they're feeling about that. So teenagers, sometimes people say, I don't think he's all there. Well, he's not.
Just give him a few years.
Yeah. Well, but they also, I mean, parental nurturance is really key around that time too. Mm-hmm. I know many parents think, oh, I'm done. He's 15, 18. Yeah. And, you know, having parental input at that time is really key. So don't withdraw from your teenage children.
Even if they withdraw from you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Well, it depends on the child and it depends on the parent. Lots of different ways. Try everything. You have to be flexible and creative.
So see what sticks, essentially.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak to Leah in Fort Worth. Hi, Leah.
Oh, hi. I wanted to ask her if she knows anything about the program called CogMed and another one called Interactive Metronome. The CogMed is supposed to work on working memory, and the claim is that a five-week training session, daily 5 weeks for an hour, will have long-term effects on working memory.
Thanks for calling. Working memory is a very big deal in terms of academic success. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know either of those programs. When programs like that started coming out, I paid attention, you know, I checked them out. They didn't have any evidence. Mm-hmm. So you have to evaluate the evidence. But I know I know key researchers who study working memories, including two of them at the University of Oregon, Ed Oh and Ed Vogel. And they and several researchers in the field of working memory claim that, oh, it's not actually that trainable or changeable.
Hmm.
And but the other thing that they have shown is, I mean, very clearly, is what controls the size of working memory is attention, focused attention. And so most of the training studies have been done with adults. We've been training attention in little kids. I mean, and you can train attention in little kids. So we have evidence that shows our attention training improves working memory in our little kids. So, but let me just say a few more things about working memory. It's remarkable individual differences in working memory. The average number of items that an adult can keep in mind are 3. But there are people who can keep 5 or 6, and there are people who can keep, like, on average, half an item in mind. And scores on working memory are very predictive of IQ, academic success, and so forth and so on.
Go ahead, if you had more to say.
I think that working memory, well, we know it's controlled by attention. We know that attention is trainable at least between the years of 3 and 8. We're not sure about after that because this reminds me to say something important. Attention, so these two mechanisms of attention, signal enhancement and distractor suppression, we can measure those in microvolts from a piece of metal on the scalp. And the effects of attention kick in at a tenth of a second after the onset of a stimulus. If your attention is there, the response to that event will be twice as large as if your attention is elsewhere. Hmm. We can measure all that. And we have studied blind people for many years, and we've shown that their auditory attentional skills are markedly enhanced compared to sighted people, and deaf people have twice as large visual attention effects as do normally hearing people. So this is a very plastic system that can be, that is enhanced in some populations. But what does that mean given the double-edged sword that plasticity is? It means, well, that's probably one of those vulnerable systems. Mm-hmm. And we have shown that. So it's a vulnerable system if the input isn't quite right. So language impaired children, we've shown they don't have this attention mechanism. You can train it up. And lower socioeconomic status children, children living below the poverty line who are typically developing. These are neurologically normal individuals. No meds, nothing. And they don't have an effective attention when we first study them. But you can train it. We're training it by training attention in children and talking to parents about parenting, including the importance of attention in their children.
So you train it, you have a series of games, and you do things like reading out loud, is that right?
Well, in our attention training, we have fun exercises like watching snails that we do with the kids. And another one, for example, is we put a piece of yarn on the floor and children are taking a little cup of water along that line to put in the fishbowl mm-hmm. without spilling. So they practice focusing and they think this is fun. And so they just practice doing that. And then they practice doing that while the kid, some of the kids are playing with balloons off in their periphery. And the balloons get closer and closer. And they get all their doctor distraction mechanisms going. And so, and then balance is another good way to practice focusing attention internally. Mm-hmm. Close your eyes, stand on one foot. And imagining things and just looking like at strawberries, say, what color is it? Red. Keep looking. Are there any other colors there? Hmm. And they go, whoa, black. Oh, keep looking. Anything else? White. So they're fun games. It's fun for the kids. And my teacher, Scott Klein, really worked hard with us to develop games that were directed toward particular parts of attention. And this was based on what we know about the architecture of attention, but that he made fun for 3, 4, and 5-year-old kids.
How long can you get a 3-year-old to look at a snail?
There are big individual differences. And they get better and better at it. They do. You can. It just gets better and better. But if you don't practice, it might not get better. And if you don't have any practice doing it in your early years, you might have problems as an adult. The differences we see in cognition and brain function in lower socioeconomic status compared to higher socioeconomic status people endure all the way till adulthood. We've studied, you know, adults who grew up in low SES environments and their brains are really different. Most people don't know that because university researchers, who do they study?
Middle-class people?
Undergraduates at the university. That's who they study. And it's very important that we, as scientists, if we want to understand the general picture about the brain, we need to sample widely from different segments of the population. Just as a reminder, your socioeconomic status is determined by your parents' education and occupation. So if your parents had a good education and a professional occupation, I mean, it's overwhelming all over the world. You will be better in language, literacy, numeracy, you'll have better health, and you'll live longer. The stats are staggering. It's a very steep gradient.
Helen Neville, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a really interesting conversation. Helen Neville is director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon. She's in town to deliver a lecture entitled Why Does a Child's Brain Develop as It Does? That takes place tonight at 7 as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can learn more about that at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. You can make a contribution to KERA to making sure that we have more great hours of radio like this one and like the one we had last hour by going online to KERA.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. You can also make your contribution online at KERA.org. Lots of people to thank this this time around, Jeff.
That's right. Heather Goodson in Irving, Kay Byfield in Garland, Angela Brewer in Dallas, Gene Jones in Plano. We also heard from Molly Knight in Waxahachie, Brian Rutledge in Fort Worth, Alicia Wilkin in Carrollton, Leslie Yaddo in Fort Worth, Veronique Lamarck in Mystic, Connecticut.
Very nice.
Remember that movie, Mystic Pizza?
Mystic Pizza.
Yeah. Wilford, thanks for listening and for contributing, Veronique. Really appreciate it. Wilford LeBaron in Dallas, really appreciate your gift as well. And Stephanie Rubel in Dallas. They've all done their part. We still have room for you to join at 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
Also want to make sure we thank Tina and Brett Rogers in Grapevine, Raquel and Chris Peterson in Rowlett, Gunilla Bollard in Highland Village, and anyone else who is on the line helping us, hopefully, to achieve this $1,500 challenge grant issued by Robert Verdon, a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. Robert Verdon said, I will give KERA an additional $1,500 if, during the 2 hours of Think on Tuesday, February, what is today, the 9th? 8th. We can get 75 contributions during the 2 hours of Think. We are coming really close. I think we are under 10 at this point, but I always hate to assume that it's going to happen because then everybody sits back and thinks, well, somebody else will take care of it. And we've missed challenges this way before. So if you would like to help us out and help us get an additional $1,500 for this radio station, let your investment of, you know, $100 or $50 or whatever go that much further because of this challenge.
Yeah, I think we're even closer than that, Chris. But they're looking at right now. It looks like they're looking at updating the numbers. It's so crucial that we hear from you to make this challenge, to make this drive a success. We have heard from over 4,600 as of this morning when I was on the air during Morning Edition, listeners during this drive. And I know we've heard from way more of you since then today. And thank you so much to each and every one of you who've made your contribution to the station during this membership campaign. The station only exists because of you and because of people like Robert Verdon, who's a wills, probate, and trust attorney in Dallas. He has said if we hear from 75 contributors at any level during Think Today, we will happily he'll happily give the station an additional $1,500. That makes a huge difference in whittling down what remains of the $700,000 goal.
Thank you so much, Nora Douglas in Dallas, and all the rest of you who are perhaps online now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. We have about $175,000 left to raise, $175,143. Be the 143.
And if that number sounds remarkably lower, it's because we made the challenge. Correct?
Excellent. But please don't stop in, you know, midway to the telephone or to the computer. Please still make your contribution because we still have to get down to the end of this goal. Thank you, all of you who helped us to make the goal this hour of the challenge grant. And thanks so much to Robert Verdon for the $1,500 challenge grant.
Yeah, we're going to be able to put that to use right away to meet all of the financial responsibilities that the station has, just like any business or any household. You know, don't let the fact that we did achieve the 75 contributions stop you from making your online contribution at kera.org or your call to 888-694-6931. Some folks that I failed to mention in the first hour, Chris, that we heard from this morning during Fresh Air and the other programs, we want to make sure we thank these folks: Betty Josie in Dallas, Mary Donnelly in Fort Worth, John Lowe in Dallas, Shun Pong in the Colony, Nelson Sue in Dallas, David Carr in Dallas, and Amanda Reynolds in Haltom City.
Thank you so much to Ronald Marusek in Dallas, Ken Dixon in Aubrey, Eric Stromberg in Dallas, Pornshree Chang in McKinney, and thank you to Joe and Lynn Guy in Fort Worth. I think that's a recent one, Joe and Lynn.
Yeah, Joe and Lynn in Fort Worth helped us meet the goal for this hour. So, and everyone is helping us meet the overall goal. You know, when we started this drive a couple weeks ago with a $700,000 goal, that's a lot of money. I mean, it's a huge undertaking. And we know that we can count on you. It's just the question of when will you make your contribution? I believe that everybody who listens to public radio has something within them that makes it possible for them, and this, I'm talking to you about you, possible for you to support the station. You know, circumstances, current economic financial circumstances notwithstanding, you have something within you that believes in the power of this kind of media, a media entity that only reports and responds to you. And that's why it's so important that you go ahead and listen to that voice that says, maybe I should give. Maybe I should go online to KERA.org. Maybe I should call 888-694-6931.
Because we're here for you, we hope that you will not sit back and wait for everybody else to pay for your public radio habit. Your contribution makes it possible for us to keep KERA strong and specifically to do think. So we'd love to hear from you now at KERA.org. Thank you so much for your contribution.
It is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton.
The production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.